Welcome to this Forthright Radio for September 20th, 2017. I'm Joy LaClaire. We have a very full show for you today. Our guest is Professor Nancy MacLean. We'll be discussing her latest book, Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America, published by Viking Press. It is a thoroughly researched, to my mind, shocking expose of the man and the ideas behind the billionaire-funded, relentless campaign to suppress voting, privatize everything from education, prisons, Social Security, and Medicare, eliminate unions, curb Democratic majority rule, and change the U.S. Constitution in order to make democracy safe for capitalism and plutocracy. Most reporting of the rise of the extreme right focuses on the Koch brothers and their money. But who created the blueprint for their decades-long stealth campaign that has been all too successful, at least so far? Our guest, Nancy MacLean, has spent a decade investigating the origins, tactics, strategy, and goals of that campaign that have brought us to this crisis point in our history. Nancy MacLean is the William Chafe Professor of History and Public Policy at Duke University. She is the award-winning author of Behind the Mask of Chivalry, The Making of the Second Ku Klux Klan, and Freedom is Not Enough, The Opening of the American Workplace. Professor MacLean's scholarship has received more than a dozen prizes and awards. In 2010, she was elected a fellow of the Society of American Historians. We welcome you now to Forthright Radio, Professor MacLean.
Thank you so much, Joy. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you here. As Mark Twain said, history does not repeat itself, but it does rhyme. And we seem to be in one of those rhyme times. After the tumultuous events of the white supremacists and those who resist them at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville, Virginia, in August, it is pertinent that your book opens there in 1956 as a young economist, James McGill Buchanan, is pitching a radical idea to then UVA president Colgate Whitehead Darden Jr. Please set the stage of that time and place for us. Who was James Buchanan, and what was he proposing, and why there?
James McGill Buchanan was a Tennessee-born economist who was trained at the University of Chicago by such people as Milton Friedman and Frank Knight. He was part of a group called the Mont Pelerin Society, or he became part soon after he came to Virginia, of this Mont Pelerin Society, which was a transnational think tank that brought together academics with business sponsors and right-wing foundations to advocate a kind of free-reign capitalism. And in 1956, Buchanan set up a branch of that project at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville, as you've said. And it was really a telling moment in Virginia history because the state of Virginia earlier that year had passed a suite of laws that were collectively described as massive resistance to Brown versus Board of Education. The laws included tax-funded vouchers, as we would call them today, to enable white parents who were segregationists to send their children to all-white private academies. It included mandate that the governor shut down any school that planned to desegregate, a plan that eventually, by 1958, left 13,000 white children without any education because their schools were going to be the ones desegregating. And it included five laws to prevent the NAACP from exercising its, you know, free speech rights. So it was really quite a radical right suite of laws. Well, that was passed in the winter of 1955 and 1956, and that fall, James Buchanan started on the campus, came as the new chair of the economics department, and he proposed a center to the university president, and he said it would be a center for study of political economy and social philosophy. And basically, he was proposing a kind of Chicago outpost in Virginia, and one that was also, in a way, beautifully tailored tailored to avoid some of the problems associated with massive resistance while still pushing the kind of agenda that Virginia's very oligarchical elite wanted in terms of this free-reign capitalism. It would include oppositions to union and unions and other forms of collective organization, opposition to social reforms, etc. So it was really very interesting that right at that moment he set up that center with also funding, startup funding, from the main funder of this ultra-free market fundamentalist cause at the time, and an organization that is the progenitor to Charles Koch's current academic organization, the Institute for Humane Studies.
It may be hard for particularly younger listeners to picture what it was like for a school child back in those days. I was raised in rural Maryland, and I'm old enough to remember what we called the colored school as separate from the white school. And it was supposedly under, I think it was Plessy versus Ferguson, right, that said it was okay to have separate but equal. Did I get that case right?
Yes, you did.
But it wasn't equal, and by no stretch of the imagination was it equal. And there was a young woman, Barbara Rose Johns, who organized her students, fellow high school students, in Prince Edward County, Virginia, for a two-week walkout. Let's talk about that and how that eventually led to the whole school system in that county being shut down.
Yes, I am happy that you picked up on that story, because not many interviewers have, and it's just so crucial. Barbara Rose Johns, as you said, was a high school student, an ambitious, wonderful, you know, curious high school student who, because she had participated in various kinds of clubs and stuff, got to travel around the state and saw how much better the white schools were than the black schools. And she was actually the niece of the radical minister who mentored Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. But anyway, she and her favorite teacher together came up with the idea for a student strike for a decent school. They were, you know, taking inspiration from the labor unions of the time, who were winning very, you know, all kinds of battles for better conditions and dignity in the 1950s. And so in 1951, they had this 100% solid student strike for a better school, and that became one of the cases that flowed into Brown versus Board of Education, the 1954 decision from the Supreme Court, about which led to a mandate to end state-sponsored segregation in education. And that was so important because, as you point out, separate was never equal. And the schools that these black children had in Virginia were awful. I mean, some of the ones, the elementary schools around the states, they still had outdoor privies, as they were called, you know, outdoor bathrooms. Many of them were one-school places. They were very weak institutions, and this high school was pathetic next to the gleaming white high school that black students were not allowed to attend. Some of the classrooms, because they were so overcrowded, they were held in tar paper shacks. The conditions were abysmal. So these students very courageously fought this, and the county leaders, the right-wing elite white county leaders, were so furious that these students had the nerve to demand a better school that they punished them after the Brown decision. And when they came under pressure to desegregate, finally in 1959, the county leaders completely shut down the public school system, left the black children with no form of formal education for 5 years, and sent white children off to a private segregated academy, the Prince Edward Academy, with tax monies from the state government. And it was just a horror, as you can imagine, for those 2,000 black children who were left without education, formal education, for 5 years. And so that's actually how I got started on this research. I had not heard about that story before. I became sort of both horrified and fascinated by how this had happened, and that trail led me to James Buchanan and ultimately to Charles Koch.
And let's briefly also set the stage in terms of where people's expectations were. It was after the Depression. It was after World War II. Just briefly say about what expectations were at that time and how this led to the reaction of Buchanan and his ilk.
Many people today think of the 1950s as a conservative time, and there's reason for that because, you know, the Cold War was on, there was a Red Scare at home that many refer to as McCarthyism and so on. But if you actually go back to the community records of the time and the organizational records, it was actually a time of real hope for a lot of people. And one key reason for that is that the labor movement was very strong. It had brought lots of workers together to stand up for their dignity, to find a collective voice, to push back, you know, to bring some democracy to their workplaces and their more democracy to their communities. And that was inspiring all kinds of groups, including civil rights groups, including a kind of nascent women's movement, Mexican Americans, and so forth. So lots of groups were coming into the public and pushing for, the Constitution says, a more perfect union, right? A more inclusive democracy and robust public policy to in their view, make America a better society. And this process that was unfolding in the late 40s in the 1950s was very alarming to some right-wing wealthy elites who already despised the New Deal of Franklin Delano Roosevelt and thought it was an outrage and it was out of keeping with American institutions and traditions. And so they had been organizing in small numbers since the 1930s. They had started up a group then called the American Liberty League. It gave rise to other groups, but they were still a very marginal presence, you know, not a lot of people involved. And what really began to make this right-wing cause a mass cause was the reaction of the conservative white South to the Brown versus Board of Education decision. And that's one of the findings that is perhaps most original in my research, is that many people have written about this ultra-free market cause as just an intellectual project until the 1970s, when it began to get traction in policy circles. But what I found is that in the 1950s, in reaction to Brown, when Southern segregationists started threatening to shut down public schools rather than desegregate them, all these Northern libertarians rallied to their side and said, isn't this great? We have a chance to end public education and pursue private education. So that was the context in which this project unfolded in Virginia, that this libertarian cause, whether or not its individual members were primarily racist or not is not the question, but they showed themselves very willing to exploit the crisis of Southern schools in this period, and in the words of Buchanan and his partner in one report they did, to let the chips fall where they may. And that's a direct quote, to let the chips fall where they may. And, of course, the chips that fell were black students' educations and a kind of an opportunity to build a kind of new interracial comedy, in, you know, C-O-M-I-T-Y, in America that was sacrificed by this push for this very ugly, belligerent, massive resistance, which in some ways I think anticipates the kind of, you know, government shutdown threats and all of those things we see from the Tea Party now, many of whose older members go back to this period.
You actually have numerous quotes that demonstrate that I don't think it's too strong to call this a conspiracy. One of the quotes is from Mr. Buchanan. He said, if the job was done right, ultimately in time, this new, quote, vast network of political power will be the establishment, quote. And then further, he says, the key thing moving forward was that, quote, conspiratorial secrecy is at all times essential, end of quote. That is one of the elements that makes me be shocked by what your research has revealed. Mm-hmm. Could you talk about the conspiratorial nature of this and why the participants felt that they had to keep so much secret?
Yeah, the quote that you read is from Buchanan's efforts in the early 1970s to convene what he called a counterintelligentsia, to push back on, you know, the kind of inclusive, liberal, radical, progressive efforts that had come out of the 1960s and the early 1970s. And he did use that language of a need for conspiratorial secrecy. Interestingly, as this project developed over time and as Charles Koch and his fellow donors got involved in funding it, it actually is not, by a legal definition, a conspiracy. conspiracy, because a conspiracy involves elements of illegality. And the sad truth is that the people funding this are so wealthy that they can hire the best legal talent to keep them on the right side of the law. So in dictionary terms, it's not a conspiracy, but on the other hand, it is concerted, deliberate action in which the leading architects are withholding from the public what their actual goals are and what their end game is. And it's something that I think we don't even yet have a word for, because inequality, we've allowed inequality in our society to progress to such a degree that we now have, I don't even know what you'd call them, it's not the whole class, but it's like a coterie of white right-wing billionaires and multimillionaires who have become so hostile to American institutions, and particularly to the way that our government works to represent citizens and to make claims on tax resources, that they are effectively trying to change the government without letting the people know that that's what they're doing. So it is a really frightening situation. And I, as a historian of the United States, can say that looking over the sweep of our history, I've never seen anything like it. And I think it is really an urgent matter that people need to know about and need to alert their fellow citizens to, because the leaders of this cause want to make the changes they're seeking permanent, and they think that they are very close to success. That's what they say among themselves.
I went to the dictionary and legal sites numerous times as a result of this book. I would say that the name we can put on this is beyond oligarchy, which means rule by the few. Yeah. It is absolutely plutocracy as a goal. That is the rule of the wealthy, which, of course, are the few. We did a show in August with Jay Riestenberg. He is the campaigns and state media strategist for Common Cause, about the movement for an Article 5 Constitutional Convention of the States. And I wish I had had your book when I interviewed him, because it puts it into context. They're very close, actually, in terms of the number of states needed to call for a constitutional convention. I would invite you to talk about that a bit, even though it's not specifically in your book.
Actually, we're going to put a new forward with us, because there were some cuts at the last minute. We cut two chapters, and I regret that this material came out, because it is so crucial. So we will have a new forward in the paperback edition. But as you're pointing out, this is probably the most important campaign that this network is now waging, is to get a constitutional convention called, and they need 34 states to do that. By people count the states somewhat differently that have signed up, but they either have 27 or 28 of the 34 states. So they're very close to that. And when they convene such a constitutional convention, they have a whole slew of what they call liberty amendments that they would put in that would basically put locks and bolts on the people's will to do any of the kinds of things we look to government to. I mean, in the end, it would have the effect of undermining Social Security and Medicare, social insurance programs, undermine regulation of our air and water quality, our ability to stop discrimination. I mean, they even want to get rid of the direct election of U.S. senators. So they want to take us back more than 100 years in terms of constitutional understanding. So it's really quite an alarming thing. And for listeners who maybe aren't aware of this, it's important to know that we have not had a constitutional convention in America since 1787, when the Constitution was written that we have now. So it would be such a radical thing for them to get this constitutional convention. So people really need to pay attention to it. There's been some very good reporting on it, but I'm afraid that all the, you know, shenanigans of Donald Trump are distracting our attention from this crucial issue. But the other thing I would say, too, is that this network is working very hard to control the states, in part to get this kind of constitutional convention going at the federal level. But they now have total dominance over 30 states. Democrats have only 6 by comparison. They have total dominance of 30 states, and one of the legal activists that Charles Koch has been funding since the 1970s, Clint Bowlick, who's now an Arizona Supreme Court justice, thanks to the Tea Party governor there, he has pointed out to this cause that it's easier to change state constitutions than federal constitutions. So they're also pushing for changes in state constitutions. So this is just something that is again, so audacious. Most of us could not even imagine that a coterie of wealthy people and that the institutions and organizations they fund and the academics they support, most of us can't even imagine that somebody would try to do something this audacious and this counter to the popular will. But they are doing it, and we need to be paying attention.
I am in Bozeman, Montana, the home of Montana State University in Bozeman, and the Koch Foundation, Koch Industries, has proposed a research center here. There was a Board of Regents meeting where critics had asked them to reject a proposed economic research center at Montana State University. I'm quoting the newspaper, charging that Charles Koch Foundation's $5.7 million grant is an attempt to use the university to promote a, quote, right-wing ideology. I would ask your response to that, but I want to include a letter to the editor written recently, headlined, Koch Brothers Grant Money is Neutral, Take It. And the writer says, regarding those protesting the Koch Brothers grant to MSU economists for various research subjects, these folks missed the point of a university. The Koch Brothers represent political positions I find abhorrent. However, their money is neutral. Take it. Use it. The researchers will either do acceptable academic research or it will be discarded. To put my position in perspective, I'm a registered Gallatin County Democrat, and I might even be a progressive if I knew what that is. Trying to block unattractive Koch thinking from the university is contrary to what a university is supposed to be doing. Cash that check before the Koch boys read your article and change their minds. Signed, Peter Thatcher in Bozeman. I wonder how you would respond to Mr. Thatcher's idea that the Koch money is neutral.
I am sure that he imagines that in good faith, but he could not be more wrong. These Koch implants at different campuses are being put in with donor agreements that deviate from the traditional norms of donor grants to universities. There is a group, a wonderful group of young researchers and organizers. Their group is called Uncoke My Campus with a K. So it's to get rid of this Koch money on campus and restore transparency, intellectual and academic integrity, and accountability. And they have reports up on their website that will show you what the problems are with these grants in place after place. The Koch, in fact, in Florida State, they actually were able to veto students' research choices. This is something that's never available to donors. They are able to set up ideologically defined faculty searches so that they can hire people who are like-minded to promote their efforts. They have set up an alternative credentialing network that is basically a kind of, you know, libertarian right activist dogmatic phenomena. So, you know, I wish that this were not the case. I wish it were just like any other donor money that universities are happy to get. But this Koch donor money is a poison pill. It is a Trojan horse that brings in a power base to universities that the Kochs are using to advance their radical right political project around our country. And again, I could say much more. Actually, you know, I hate to tout my own book, but readers should really read the story of George Mason University, where the main such Koch campus implant is. And it was actively political from the outset. A whistleblower donor said that it was probably illegal the way they were using this campus outpost, and they had strategically put it at George Mason University right across the river from right across the Potomac from Washington, D.C., so they could influence the nation's politics. These are absolutely political efforts, no matter what gets said in their defense. And again, I urge your listeners to go to the website of Uncoke My Campus and see the research materials that they've put together there and decide for themselves. But I think these things are a terrible Trojan horse in higher ed.
We're speaking with Professor Nancy McLean. Her book, Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America, goes into detail, heavily footnoted. It's very controversial. You've gotten quite a reaction from libertarian circles. Professor McLean.
Yeah, it's actually only controversial with libertarians, I want to point out. It's actually been very well reviewed and excerpted, and I've been interviewed all over in the mainstream media and other parts of the media, but the libertarians, who are both the operatives at these organizations funded by the Koch donor network and the academics, we were just talking about the dangers of these academic centers, academics who are funded by Koch, who attack me and try to steer people away from the book without disclosing their own financial indebtedness to this Koch cause. So there's a real dishonesty there that is very troubling for our public life. But basically, the attacks have been almost entirely from people who are financially connected to this Koch donor network. And there's a lot of them now. I mean, there are literally, if you count the state organizations in the state policy network that they have and the international organizations in the Atlas network, along with the dozens of national organizations that this donor network funds, you get to hundreds of organizations. So they have lots of staff and lots of people with time on their hands to attack anybody who says anything that might expose what they're up to, but they are not broadly representative. And in fact, I'll just add, it was very interesting that when they started these attacks, you know, I knew that some of them were coming, obviously, from George Mason, where the big Koch presence is, from George Mason University. But I didn't know all the other ones, but a young man who works for Greenpeace as a researcher, a young man named Connor Gibson, started sending me links. He had looked up their conflicts of interest, the grants that they had gotten from the Koch Foundation that they had not disclosed when they made these attacks on me. He did so because he recognized the MO from what the Koch donor network does to climate scientists. So these are, you know, legitimate, good climate scientists trying to alert us to the dangers to our planet, and the Koch network organizations try systematically to defame them in order to minimize the urgency of climate change because they don't want to see government action. So I think that this is actually has become, at this point, I'm starting to say, a deadly ideology, because you look at the people who died in the recent hurricanes, Harvey and Irma, hurricanes that were made worse by climate change that this donor network is steadfastly determined to prevent action on, and you start to see what a calcified dogma and deadly ideology this is. And again, the Koch donor network is using these academic implants to advance that kind of agenda. And any donor who tries to throw sand in the eyes of the citizenry about something as scientifically uncontroversial as climate change is not a kind of donor that should be welcome on a campus in America, in my view.
Well, let's get back to James McGill Buchanan. I had never heard of him before your book. He was actually awarded a Nobel Prize in economics in 87, I believe. But
86,
he...
Yeah.
He was the architect of this blueprint, and he and some of his early colleagues actually were talking about how Lenin orchestrated the communist revolution in Russia that became the Soviet Union. And they studied Lenin. They admire him. We've, of course, heard Steve Bannon talk about being a Leninist, but so is this whole group. And one of the elements was forming a cadre of this counterintelligentsia that you brought up. Talk about that and how that has led to the tentacles in so many colleges and universities. Please talk about that.
Yeah, well, I should say Buchanan did want to create a counterintelligentsia, and from the very beginning, although in public he presented the school of political economy that he was developing, public choice economics is the broad term for it. The more restrictive term for his variant is Virginia political economy, but he... Absolutely. In public, he would say that this was a science, you know, that it was neutral, that everybody else was romantic, and he was the realist, and this was a science. But in private, I, you know, got access to his correspondence, and it was very political from the outset, and he was presenting that way to corporate donors and to other donors, saying that he was out to change the way people thought about government as part of this right-wing effort. And so I should say also, though, that I didn't find anything in the archives or in other sources with Buchanan Buchanan himself talking about Lenin as a model, but I did find another early Koch grantee, a libertarian named Murray Rothbard, actually brought Lenin to Charles Koch's attention in the 1970s as Koch was getting more serious about having an influence in politics. And this Murray Rothbard, who was, you know, living at Koch largesse and writing, he was a very prolific writer, Rothbard said, you know, that of course both of them opposed communism, that should go without saying, but he alerted Koch to Lenin, the leader of the Bolshevik Revolution, because he said Lenin's genius about strategy and tactics showed how a minority could pull off a revolution, even though they didn't have the majority. And so in Koch's case, of course, they don't need violence for their revolution. They have so much money to fund organizations, suppress votes, do all these other things that they're doing. They don't need violence. But they did get from Lenin, in particular, as you're saying, the notion of the need for a disciplined cadre. And that's what they talked about as they were building up these academics. You know, they were supporting all these academics in the 1970s and thereafter, creating pipelines. Koch wanted what he called the top talent pipeline. He said our greatest shortage is talent. We need more people. We need more trained cadre. So they talked about cultivating this hardcore, as they called it, libertarian cadre that would be steeped in their worldview and that would go out into other institutions, whether those are academic institutions or the Republican Party, which they ended up taking over with these donor monies. Yes, they were absolutely trying to get this libertarian hardcore that would not compromise and by their terms would not bend. And again, that's why it's so frightening to see a Koch presence in our institutions of higher education, because they are pushing, this Koch network is pushing a messianic ideology. It is absolutely an ideology, which means it's not susceptible to ordinary empirical challenge or reasoned discussion or debate. These guys are trained to carry the line like a Leninist cadre would, and so for them to go into a higher education institution is the equivalent of bringing in just some political zealot. These are not ordinary scholars. They're part of this larger project, and citizens and voters and decision makers in the universities, administrators and faculty really need to know that.
Well, you brought up messianic. There's the Samaritan's dilemma that James Buchanan wrote about, and which you then kind of said, he said that Jesus was wrong. Mm-hmm. How does that work?
Yeah, this was really interesting to me. I mean, this whole thing has been fascinating to me, you know, because I'm a historian of the United States, who has focused over the years on social movements and how they influence public policy and politics. And so this, I entered a whole new world with this research project, and I was just stunned at what I found there, because basically what I learned is that this libertarian ideology, when you really study it and you get into it, it's actually antithetical to every major religious tradition in the world, I believe. And the piece that you just identified from Buchanan makes that clear. Buchanan wrote a piece in 1975, I believe it was, called The Samaritan's Dilemma, and he basically used the Jesus's parable of the Good Samaritan and turned it on its head. And Jesus had used this parable to illustrate why a good Christian needs to care, you know, needs to be kind to someone who is a victim of violence or abuse, someone who's an outsider. And Buchanan turned that around and said, no, I'm sorry, but in the modern world, that will lead to predators. I mean, he treated this beaten man in Jesus' parable, lying on the roadside, he treated this beaten victim of violence as though he were a predator on the wealthy taxpayer. That's what he was using. That's what Buchanan used the Samaritan's Dilemma to do, to say, to try to persuade his audiences that in the modern world, Jesus's ethics didn't apply, that Jesus was wrong, in effect, for the 20th and 21st century. And Buchanan actually used this dehumanizing language from the animal world of parasites. He talked about those who are net recipients of tax funds, say people who are poorer, who need health assistance or, you know, what have you. He talked about them as parasites on the productive, and he used a language, and he did it in that article, of predators and prey. And for Buchanan, the predators were all of those who made claims on government for the use of tax revenues beyond what they themselves had paid. And the prey were the wealthier taxpayers who didn't approve of these public purposes but were made to pay taxes. And you know, you mentioned earlier Charlottesville, and I have to say, you know, as I was watching the horror unfold in Charlottesville with these neo-Nazis marching in our streets, I flash back to that language of predators and prey and parasites and thought about how systematically this libertarian ideology has been propounded by these Koch-funded institutions over time, and that it's basically led to millions of Americans thinking about our fellow human beings and citizens. Not in those terms as fellow human beings and citizens of equal dignity and worth, but instead in this animal language of predators and prey that really, I think, licenses aggression of the kind we're now seeing in our politics. You know, and I don't think that James Buchanan, you know, anticipated that that's where it would land. You know, he was very much the scholar. He was trying to teach intellectual opinion, but he lined up these right-wing think tanks and these donors like Koch and fed them what became ammunition for this cause to undermine our common belief in the public interest and the common good and to transform our institutions. And I think we're reaping the whirlwind as a result.
In fact, as an example, at least some of these people would say that public schools are socialism and yes, we need to get rid of them, and that people who use the public schools are the parasites. They upended the language so that the wealthy are the victims and the poor are, as you say, the predators. Well, I want to move on because there's so much more to cover. In terms of strategy, Buchanan gave kind of a blueprint of how to get rid of Social Security, for example.
Yeah.
Would you talk about that, please? Because it's unfolding now.
Yeah, and I'm so glad that I'm talking to you that you're in Montana, too, because I'm trying to get out of the, you know, sort of the bubble, you know, and get to places like my own home state now of North Carolina, which are really being affected by these ideas. And I'm sure there are many people probably in your listening audience who may have voted for, you know, the older people may have voted for Ronald Reagan, but may not have known that this libertarian cause was looking to Ronald Reagan to make radical cuts to Social Security and Medicare, among other changes, but that President Reagan actually backed up from the brink with his first budget. He realized how unpopular that would be, even with his own voters and core constituents, and he didn't do it. And so this libertarian cause was terribly frustrated with that, and that's why they're using the stealth strategy they are now, because they were repeatedly disappointed by Republican elected officials who had to face the voters and wouldn't do what these donors and ideologues wanted. And so after President Reagan pulled back from the brink in 1983, James Buchanan advised the Cato Institute, which had originally started as the Charles Koch Foundation, so it was, you know, Charles Koch's enterprise, it's the Cato Institute, and still is, this libertarian think tank in Washington. Buchanan explained to them how they could take down Social Security without telling the voters what they were doing. And he actually said, and I have the quotes in the book, he started from saying that there was no support anywhere in the American public for radical changes to Social Security. And he went through, he said, neither black nor white nor brown, neither rich or poor, neither Sunbelt or Frostbelt, neither male nor female. Nobody wants radical changes to Social Security. But instead of saying, ah, it's a popular program, we should leave it there because that's what our fellow Americans want, no, he and Charles Koch wanted to continue to undermine this program and to switch us away in, from, you know, to individual accounts that would be invested ultimately with Wall Street firms. So what Buchanan proposed was what I call a crab walk. That he said it would be political suicide to tell the voters that that's what you, you know, to tell the voters what you really wanted, which was the end of Social Security as social insurance. And so instead, Buchanan proposed a multi-step program. And the first thing he advocated was to try to convince the electorate that Social Security was not viable, that it was, as he put it then, and you've probably heard since from people like Ted Cruz and others, a Ponzi scheme, and that it wasn't viable. And so since then, I'm sure people who are listening to your show will have seen many of those ads that are funded by these dark money billionaire groups who don't really tell you who they are, that say, oh my gosh, Social Security won't be there for you, you know, what will happen, just this kind of scaremongering. So that was step one, to make them think and make people think that Social Security wouldn't be there for them. Step two, and this all comes out of Buchanan's School of Political Economy, Public Choice, was to target those who would pay the most attention to any change in Social Security, the people for whom it was really salient. That was the existing recipients of Social Security and those about to get Social Security. For this group, Buchanan advised, and this is his language, paying off the existing claims. And his explanation for that was these are the people who would pay most attention to protecting the program, who are most likely to rally in its support, so you needed to get them out of the fight. I mean, that's pretty serious strategy, right? Get them out of the fight. Then he had a whole slew of other, I think like three or four other groups to be targeted, but the one that I found most chilling is young people. And I think, you know, that this, I just cannot stress this enough, because this radical libertarian cause, they all used to affirm that they were radicals, right, that they were not conservatives. They specifically disavowed the label conservative. But since Charles Koch went into politics, they have kind of hidden behind the label conservative, and they're now flying under that flag, but they are so radical, and this point, I think, will show it. They have been pushing since then on this advice from Buchanan to target young people, to turn them against retired people on the ground that, in Buchanan's words, Social Security provides a tremendous welfare subsidy to the aged. Now, show me a conservative cause in history that ever tried to get young people to oppose effectively their grandparents and the elders in their community in a kind of class warfare style. You won't find it, because real conservatism is about protecting institutions, is about protecting, you know, traditions and legacies, and looks to the wisdom of those who are aged. But this cause is actively trying to rally young people. They even have a group called Generation Opportunity that does it with paid operatives. They try to rally young people against Social Security and against Medicare, saying that old people are kind of preying on young people. So it's really, really something. But that first story of Social Security and how Buchanan advised on attacking it, I think, is emblematic of this larger stealth strategy that begins from the assumption that if they tell the truth to the public, it will be political suicide, in Buchanan's phrase, so they must go around and instead change the rules, change our institutions, suppress voting, gerrymander to misrepresent the will of the electorate, and so forth, in order to get through this radical, reckless program that I truly believe, as a scholar and as a citizen, from all that I've studied, would result in an utterly unsustainable society.
We are seeing a push, particularly in the current Congress, towards what is being called federalism. Senator Graham, for example, with his alternative to the Affordable Care Act that's being rushed through Congress now, is promoting the idea of sending the money to the states, and that's better than having the federal government oversee it. And even the term competitive federalism, would you please talk about that and how it affects
the average
person?
Yes, that is straight out of the Buchanan playbook. Actually, federalism is really another name for states' rights, you know, when it's used in that way. And Buchanan, as we talked about earlier, had come out of this elite Southern context that, you know, where Southern elites of the mid-century repressed votes and fought against Democratic initiatives coming from the federal government using states' rights to shield their systems, which held down moderate white voters and white working class people along with African Americans. They did all of that under the guise of states' rights. And so Buchanan, particularly when he started working with Charles Koch in earnest, began convening corporate executives and Republican elected officials and right-wing foundations and so forth to conferences in the 1990s, urging, as you said, well, he advocated what he called actions on the spectrum of secession, i.e. secession like the Civil War, secession, that word. And he said that those actions, you know, he said you couldn't do secession ever since the Civil War, but what you could do was actions on the spectrum of secession. And so he said privatization, federalism, decentralization, and so forth. And so this thing that Lindsey Graham is pushing and that other people who are kind of pursuing this program in Washington are pushing is precisely that kind of Buchananite effort to undermine the democracy that comes with national oversight. This is a cause that, because of Buchanan's focus on politics, understands that most Americans, sadly, do not pay attention to state politics. Usually less than 20% of people pay attention to state politics right now, and that skews older and wealthier. People pay attention to national politics, so they're trying to move everything they can away from the national oversight into the states, which are much easier for corporations to control and for unaccountable legislators to control who have gerrymandered their seats, so it's very hard to get rid of them. So I hope that your listeners will pay close attention to anything that is put forward with that language of federalism, because it's actually doing what Buchanan urged, which was using the threat of exit to gain power that you can't achieve through actually making your case directly and honestly to the people and letting them vote in their majorities.
So Buchanan finally retired and died, and this fellow Tyler Cowen, who succeeded him and directs the base camp at George Mason, the Mercatus Center, he actually says that it's going to be, you know, kind of hard for a lot of people, but liberty for the wealthy is really the most important thing. I'm totally paraphrasing him on that.
Yeah.
But here's a quote. Lower income parts of America, quote, will be recreating a Mexico-like or Brazil-like environment, end of quote, complete with favelas like those in Rio de Janeiro. Quality of water might not be what U.S. citizens are used to, but partial shanty towns would satisfy the need for cheaper housing as wage polarization grows and government shrinks. Quote, some version of Texas and then some is the future for a lot of us, end quote, the economist advises, quote, get ready, end of quote. So what should we get ready for, Professor McLean?
Yeah, I'm glad you shared that. I just found that absolutely breathtaking. And I think it's really important that you raise that, too, because I'll bet, or I hope at least, that some of your listeners will be longtime Republican voters. My dad was a Republican voter all his life until 2000. Very good man, basically kind of an Eisenhower Republican, you know, who was concerned about fiscal matters, but I hope your listenership has Republican voters, and I hope also perhaps some activists, grassroots activists who were involved with the Tea Party or Americans for Prosperity, because they need to know how cynical the Kochs and their fellow donors and the, I've come to call them apparatchiks, in these programs are. And I'm on the mailing list, so I know what the ordinary voters who ally with these things are told. They get mailings that talk about the pro-growth agenda, limited government, giving you back more of your taxes. You know, those are things that sound good to most people. Like, why wouldn't you be for those things? So it's understandable that people have bought into this, many, many good people of goodwill. But they need to know that Tyler Cowen, that world Tyler Cowen outlines, that's where this is really heading. This cause, as I've said, is not telling people what their real goals are or their real end game, but you see it in things like that Tyler Cowen quote that you just read. They know that if their program goes through, we will see levels of inequality in America like nothing we've ever seen before. I mean, just the fact that somebody is talking about, like, you know, Mexico and Brazil favela-style shanty towns in America. Cowen was also talking about how the water quality in many places wouldn't be what Americans were used to. And all your listeners have to think of is what happened to Flint, Michigan, with one of these people at the helm. So it's really, really a dark vision that they envision when they tell the truth for the rest of us as these policies go through. And basically what this libertarian cause believes is legitimate for government to do are just three things: provide for the national defense, ensure the rule of law, and ensure social order. Just those three things. Everything else they consider illegitimate. So government should not be helping to make sure that you have retirement security with your Social Security. Government should not be providing Medicare to help older Americans cope with their medical expenses. As you said, in the dream world of this libertarian cause, we would not have public education. Parents would be individually responsible for paying for their children's schooling as they are for their own retirements and their health insurance and so forth. So it is really a stark world. When they say personal responsibility, that's what they mean. If you and I say personal responsibility, we're people who take responsibility for our lives. You know, we get up and brush our teeth, and from there on through the day and through the years, we're doing all kinds of things to be responsible for ourselves. But most of us understand that in the modern world, we can't do that entirely on our own. We need our paved roads. We need our electric lights. We need our schools. We need clean air and water that we can count on. We need all those things. But these libertarians want to undermine our ability to use government for common purposes like these. So,
Professor McLean, I am really so sorry to interrupt you, but we are absolutely out of time. There is so much more to discuss on this topic, and you've done a great service in doing the decades of research that you've done. Thank you so much for joining us today on Forthright
Radio. Thank you, Joy, for being such an excellent host. Bye-bye.
We've been speaking with Professor Nancy McLean about her latest book, Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America, published by Viking Press. And of course, the views expressed on Forthright Radio are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of KZYXZ staff, its members, board of directors, or contributors. Forthright Radio is a Beyond the Deep End production, broadcast each first and third Wednesday of the month from the Philo Studios of KZYXNZ, Mendocino County Public Broadcasting. Engineer Rich Culbertson, I'm Joy LeClaire.